Welcome to the Grace in Common podcast, a conversation between four friends, four theologians from four countries on three continents. My name is James Eglinton. I teach theology at the University of Edinburgh in Scotland. I'm joined today by my regular co-hosts, Corey Brock, pastor of St. Columba's Free Church in Edinburgh and also lecturer at Edinburgh Theological Seminary, Grace Utanto, professor of theology, of systematic theology at Reformed Theological Seminary in Washington, D.C., Marinus de Jong, pastor of the Oosterpark Kerk in Amsterdam, and also of the Neo-Calvinism Research Institute. And we're recording this live all together in one room at the Kuiper Conference at Calvin University in Grand Rapids, Michigan. And we're joined by a special guest, Dr. Greg Parker. So to introduce our guest, Greg Parker is Assistant Professor of Theology at Cairn University. He did his PhD at the University of Edinburgh on Herman Bavinck. He's also probably theology's biggest Tame Impala superfan. I don't think I've ever heard Greg give a presentation where Tame Impala wasn't mentioned. But we're here to talk with Greg about some of his work in Neo-Calvinism. So you're a bit of a powerhouse in translation, together with Cam Clossing, also a University of Edinburgh graduate. So in recent years, you guys have worked on let's run us through them. A bunch of Bavinck publications that we wouldn't have in English without your input.
Yeah, so the first one, and thank you so much. Thanks so much, guys, for having me on. Maybe this time I can be the fifth friend instead of just four friends hanging out.
Yeah, we class you as a friend.
All right, perfect. Cam and I got together, I think, at an ETS in 2018, and we're kind of thinking through the Bavinck landscape and realized maybe one of the underappreciated aspects of his thought at that point were his pastorally oriented works. And so we decided that we would take that upon ourselves, the burden of translating those works that were oriented towards maybe congregation members. And so at first we took up Sacrifice of Praise, which was actually already in English, so maybe that was a bit of a cop-out. But it was, we thought, kind of poorly translated. And so we'd give it our first go. This was a work that looked at kind of the time in between in a Dutch Christian's life in which they would confess their faith but not yet participate in the Lord's Supper. And so this was a book that would kind of propel them to partake in the Lord's Supper. After that, I think probably the most fun book that we took on was Guidebook for Instruction in the Christian Religion, which is a systematic theology intended for really high schoolers. I think the fun anecdote is that at this point in Bavinck's life, when this was published, 1913, his daughter would have been a high schooler. So we really think it's, you know, the premier theologian in the Netherlands writing a systematic theology for his daughter, which is really endearing, and I think makes people put it in their Amazon cart. Cam, I've also translated What is Christianity, which is really two works put together, kind of thinking through the essence of Christianity, and then most recently, Biblical and Religious Psychology by Bavinck. So getting a little bit further away from the pastorally oriented stuff there, but translation nonetheless.
Great. So one thing that we were keen to talk about with you is something that you contributed on quite a lot through your PhD thesis, and that's encyclopedia within theology. This is a big thing in Bavinck's domain. And I guess for the way that theology is taught in the English-speaking world, encyclopedia is, at least it's not a label that most people are very familiar with. Although just before we started recording, and I was talking about this with Marinus as a Dutch-formed theologian, encyclopedia is just a standard part of the training that you had. And yet this wasn't a discipline that I was taught in a Reformed seminary at the same time on the other side of the North Sea. It'd be great if we could talk that through with you in terms of what it is, what it was like, what theological encyclopedia meant for Herman Bavinck, for example, and then maybe update the conversation to think today. Because I guess for a lot of listeners who are not in the Netherlands, this will actually probably be quite new to them as well. Before that, can you give us your whole thesis in a nutshell, though?
Yeah, certainly. So worked with you, James, in Edinburgh, looking at the relationship between Bavinck's dogmatics and ethics. The elevator pitch would kind of be scholars before me were convinced that it was only one thing that related those two things, and my argument was that many things related the two disciplines. And amidst this, I had the opportunity to be at the Free University of Amsterdam's archives, which are now lovely put forth for us on the internet. But in a prior time, we all had to make the trek to Amsterdam. I'm a little bit sad, actually, that PhD students don't have the opportunity to do that anymore. But kind of scouring through his archival material, looking for just really any time that dogmatics and ethics were coming up in the same context. And one of these was in a folder amidst all this stuff about theological encyclopedia. And for me, and probably I just assume most people, if you say the word encyclopedia, your eyes kind of immediately glaze over. And just, you want to be put to sleep because it sounds like a very boring concept. For me, and maybe Corey, as a fellow American, we might have these kind of memories of maybe guys visiting our parents when we were kids, trying to sell like extended or distended dictionaries, these encyclopedias that kind of contained all of knowledge. And this was really what, in the American mindset at least, like an encyclopedia is, really just a bloated dictionary. But in the broader theological context, an encyclopedia was more like an interdisciplinary curriculum that kind of mapped out how the various sciences related to each other. And this wasn't just a linear thing or even just, you know, mechanical, but actually it was kind of a living relation between all the sciences. And so every science would have its own encyclopedia that kind of processed self-reflectively how it was as a science, what its purpose was for, what its object was, and really just what was it doing as a science and how was it relating to other sciences. And so theology then has its own encyclopedia, its own kind of processing of what is theology, what is it for, what is its other sciences, and then maybe most importantly, how does it relate to itself? You know, what does practical theology have to do with church history and so on and so forth? And this was a very lively discipline in the Netherlands, especially during Bovink's life. So he would have taught encyclopedia. In terms of training of ministers and theologians, they really would have been taught it twice at this point. They would have been taught it at the very beginning of their academic career to kind of like allow them to see that there are many forests or many trees in the forest, and then at the end to kind of bring everything back together after they have gotten to the nitty-gritty of it.
So you're talking about it in the past tense, but for Marinus, what was encyclopedia like for you as a student?
When I started my bachelor's in Kampen back in 2005, you would see that one of the in the first year there would be the subject of encyclopedia would be on the list, and of course as a student you had exactly the same reflection as you had. Encyclopedia, what's going to happen? Are we going to like read an encyclopedia? What's this going to be? So you have no clue. And it's good that you bring into memory that it used to be at the beginning and the end of the curriculum. But it wasn't anymore the case when I came in. It was only at the beginning, which is sad because so you get, before you know what theology is, kind of, or when you're starting to approach it, you get this whole overview of the interrelatedness of all the theological subjects. Right? You get to go, okay, so this is what theology is. We got a definition, working definition, also like different definitions that could be used. And then, okay, you have practical theology, systematic theology, and then definitions of what that is and how they interrelate it. But you have no idea what those topics are. And I remember being like a couple of years down in my studies, thinking back, okay, that was really interesting that we did that. But so I took a look back into the reader we had to get another look at it. So I kind of did what was supposed to be done at the end to go back to, because in the beginning it's kind of too early because you have no idea what it is. So I didn't realize until just before this conversation that this is not a normal part of theology. But I suppose you have something here, right? Something that explains, okay, what is our field and how do the different disciplines relate to each other? But you apparently have a different name for it, or maybe it's how is it taught in the curriculum?
Yeah, so when I was in seminary at Westminster, basically they taught that in a class called Prolegomena. And so they would relate systematic theology to biblical theology, to church history, historical theology, pastoral theology, counseling, all those sorts of issues, which we would now call theological encyclopedia in this context. And an RTS curriculum, I think we covered that in the introduction to pastoral and theological studies right at the very beginning as well. So it's not so much at the end, but at the very beginning, the things you say beforehand to organize all things. But I've got a question for Greg now. And, you know, when I think theological encyclopedia, the first thing that comes into my mind is Schleiermacher's Brief Outlines of the Study of Theology. And when I meet folks who are like, oh, nothing good comes out of liberal theology, nothing good comes out of Schleiermacher, I ask them, do you believe in historical theology as a theological discipline? They say yes. I'm like, well, you're standing on Schleiermacher's feet. So I want to know what your thoughts are, Greg, with respect to Boving's Theological Encyclopedia in relation to this very, let's say, fecund work by Schleiermacher.
Yeah, Schleiermacher's encyclopedia had a huge impact on just even the scope of theological encyclopedia. So prior to Schleiermacher, as Marinus just mentioned, there was really a fourfold theological encyclopedia of practical, historical, exegetical, and systematic or dogmatic. After Schleiermacher, so in Schleiermacher's Brief Outline, he really does a threefold encyclopedia, which is philosophical, practical, and historical. Practical being really the premier crown of the encyclopedia for Schleiermacher. Philosophical really focusing on the essence of Christianity question, and then historical, really almost the rest of what we would consider the encyclopedia getting collapsed into that. So we would see exegetical, history, systematic, all being in this really historical category. In Boving's exposure to encyclopedia, we have from his student notes, day one of encyclopedia when he was at the University of Leiden, he was taking with L.W. Rauenhoff. And day one, first line, it says, and Schleiermacher changed the landscape of the encyclopedia and completely reversed it. And so we see from his student notes that there was this huge influence of Schleiermacher. In Boving's own encyclopedia, he really sees himself as trying to overcome the shortcomings of Schleiermacher, trying to retrieve or go back to a Reformed Orthodox take on encyclopedia. So he returns to really a fourfold encyclopedia because he thinks this emphasis that's being placed on the practical by Schleiermacher is just too heavy and can't be born without the other categories.
I just plug into that. So I think what you said for historical theology, Gray, can also be said for practical theology, because the whole idea of practical theology, I think, also comes from Schleiermacher, if I'm not wrong. And I think when I was in Kampen, I think we just had made a transition from what we called amtelijke vakken, which means like disciplines related to the office, right? Like official subjects or something. And that was used to be the name of practical theology, and we changed it into practical theology. So I think also in Boving's outline of encyclopedia, and certainly in Kuiper's, there's no such thing as practical theology. It is amtelijke vakken or something related. I think Kuiper has something like diaconologische vakken or something, like deaconry subjects. I'm not sure what Boving does. But so do you recognize this in Boving or what?
Yeah, so I think Kuiper and Boving are different there, where Kuiper does have that and Boving has more of this practical.
So he uses practical theology,
yeah,
Boving.
I believe so.
Oh, interesting. So that didn't continue in Kampen then, apparently. Because it used to be like still amtelijke vakken and not practical theology. Fascinating.
So my question is, to what degree does encyclopedia participate and have a relation to historic Christian theological practice? So how do we talk about this in pre-Enlightenment times? So is this something that we see the church doing throughout the ages? Because I think, you know, you think so much of the French encyclopedist that came along with the French Revolution, you think of this as something that's highly specialized work. And so, in your own thought and research, how does modern encyclopedia, theological encyclopedia, relate to patristics or medieval or Reformation theology? Do we see this prior?
Yeah, so I think this is probably actually why it's landed in the American context in Prolegomena, because it really, from the earliest days, at least in Boving's archival notes, he sees this as developing out of the reflection on what theology is. Developing out of the context of what theology is. And then through this process, he kind of traces it, how various theologians throughout time have thought about this issue and then how it became institutionalized within the university context. And so then the university takes up this task of kind of reflecting on the process of what theology is. And then getting into like maybe post-Schleiermacher and into modern time, this idea of the encyclopedia becomes for Bavinck this self-consciousness of theology. So this is kind of like the modern tune of the encyclopedia, and that theology itself as a discipline, in order for it to develop further, needs to reflect on what it is and what it is for, right? And so this is really what he sees as the issue in Schleiermacher's encyclopedia, is that if Schleiermacher is overly philosophical in its bearings, then it's not developing theologically, right? And we know for Bavinck that theology must be theological. So this is really the big push for Bavinck in trying to recover or move past Schleiermacher, is to have an encyclopedia that is truly focused on what theology is, right, and then truly theological. I'd be really interested to know how this might link up with Christianity and Science and some of his reflections on the university.
Yeah, I think the idea of theology when it becomes intellectually self-conscious and therefore needing to prompts encyclopedias, that's one of the great contributions of your thesis. For me, that was I love that insight. I think for Corey's question, another way that we could answer it, well, I think Abraham Kuyper tried to answer the same question in his Encyclopedia of Sacred Theology. And I guess one of the unfortunate things about the history of translation and Neo-Calvinism, go back to where we started off there, is that Kuyper's Encyclopedia is this huge three-volume work. And only volume 2 and the first 53 pages of volume 1 were translated into English. And that's a real shame because of how it's affected our perception of, in the English-speaking world, if we're aware of Encyclopedia through Neo-Calvinism, a lot of people, if they've read that text by Kuyper at all, probably struggle to work out how isn't this just systematic theology or dogmatic theology. So the structure of Kuyper's Encyclopedia is that part one is a really long historical excursus of people trying to do what you were just asking about, Corey. How do I take lots of different avenues of inquiry and fields of knowledge and knit them all together? And then what's the thing that emerges when you take that encyclopedic view of knowledge? And he begins in the ancient Greek world and then takes you all the way up to contemporary thought in his day, where you can see the increasing sophistication of attempts to develop what becomes encyclopedic knowledge. So there's this human impulse to do this. And there are some figures who occupy really special places in the narrative, and above all, Augustine and then Thomas Aquinas are the paradigm shift moments in the move towards encyclopedic knowledge. But part one of the whole thing is the historical question. And it's not just theologians who are there in the list. There are a lot of philosophers as well. Part two is what Greg was just talking about. When theology is one of those avenues of inquiry, becomes self-aware, it needs to be part of a bigger encyclopedia. And part two is his explanation of theology becoming aware of what it is as a distinct way of thinking. And then part three is theology relating to all of the other avenues of inquiry around it. So it's kind of an argument for something like the Free University of Amsterdam again. So the whole package is just, it's massive. And each of the volumes is, 600 or 700 pages. It's a really long work, but we only have the middle section and only 53 pages of volume one. So it's a really misleading translation in terms of what it's part of. But I think I wonder if all of Kuyper's encyclopedia had been translated, and this was ages ago that it came out in English, if we had the whole thing, maybe we would be having a completely different conversation on this podcast. Maybe Greg would have written a totally different PhD, and maybe all of us would have had some kind of encyclopedic training in as people who were formed in English-speaking seminaries, differently to how we did anyway.
Yeah, it probably would have been something with Tame Impala and Bavinck instead.
No doubt.
So in terms of theology being self-conscious and aware of its own self, the enterprise of theological encyclopedia requires a theological view and concepts, theological concepts that precondition the possibility of doing the encyclopedia, right? So you mentioned this thirst to know that humanity has. So, did you touch on something like that? I think, it's the doctrine of the image of God. It's the organism of creation, the organism of knowledge that are the realities, the metaphysical realities that condition the possibility of even pursuing encyclopedia. So why is it that humans want to do this and what are we gaining from it and all these sorts of things? So, there are unique Neo-Calvinist theological concepts that make encyclopedia something that we want to do and that we think is really valuable, right? So just wondering if you reflected on that much. Or...
Yeah, so the early chapters of my dissertation, I kind of linked Bavinck up with Augustine and kind of the human person wanting to seek understanding, and particularly kind of this faith seeking understanding. And I landed at really drawing on Bavinck's articulation of a worldview, and that in this process of seeking understanding, you're really trying to cultivate this world and life view, which I think actually links up very neatly with theological encyclopedia, especially in the university context, where a university or theology as a discipline, much like a human person, has this self-consciousness in which they're trying to develop and cultivate this comprehensive vision of knowledge, both for the subject or for the individual, right, which results in a worldview, and then for the institution, which results in some sort of encyclopedia for theology itself, a theological encyclopedia. So I do think there's this cute kind of pairing between the two that you arrive at through really a distinctly neo-Calvinist vision.
Since you mentioned Christianity and science, Greg, we just led a conversation on this in the Bavinck class at RTSDC, and he does talk about the organism of science right in the beginning of the section on the natural sciences, and he was trying to say that because knowledge and science is a single organism, there's going to be unity within the diversity, and the diversification of the sciences is going to be natural because in an organism it continues to grow, but at the diversification of the sciences shouldn't forget the unity, even as we continue to develop these different fields. And when he considers the benefits of Christianity for science, he actually argues, you know, at least two of the different benefits that he says is that, well, first, Christianity offers this vision of a objective singular truth that needs to be received by the human consciousness. And that reception within that human consciousness is precisely what leads to the flowering of the sciences. And secondly, interestingly enough, you know, you mentioned the self-consciousness of theology. He says, theology as a science itself is fueled by the Christian worldview, and is itself a blessing of the Christian faith. So it's interesting that in Christianity and science, he seems to maybe presuppose a lot of the ideas from Kuyper's Encyclopedia, because he was a lot briefer there. But it was very explicit that the encyclopedia idea itself draws from Christianity, because of its revelation, its resources to form that organic character of science. And I wonder if you touched on that as well.
I didn't really I'll touch on that. I certainly got into kind of the organism of knowledge, but beyond that, no, I didn't really explore it.
So my question now is, how do you talk about this to people in the church? So what are the benefits at a more local and popular level of exploring the realities that the concepts that we've been talking about? Yeah, so in your involvement in church, where do you see some of the takeaways, perhaps?
Yeah, maybe two. One, it's that we can see that theology itself is a very serious discipline, rigorous by its own nature. I think one of the things in being exposed to a lot of students is that I think deconstruction kind of falls upon them because we present to them a naive vision of what theology is, almost a recapitulating for them of their Sunday school years in the classroom. Mm-hmm. And because of this, they don't realize how rich of a science theology is. And I think encyclopedia helps to kind of begin to push them into the ocean of recognizing that there's a lot of rigorous thought here. Second, I think it moves us in the direction of realizing that there are specialties, and these specialties can all benefit the church. And maybe this is where Schleiermacher was right about something, which is that theology is ultimately must have some sort of bend towards the church. And in that way, I think there's this goodness, right, that theology can be a gift for the church. And so that would be how I would kind of, I guess, pitch it to my mom if I was going to talk to her about this. I would say, yeah, this PhD, these deep, rigorous studies that, I did, Mom, ultimately it can have this end goal of helping the local church.
Shout out to Greg's mom.
Yeah, always.
Yeah. I wonder, maybe one way we could think about this is from one of the plenary lectures here at this conference yesterday, which was on why economists need people of faith is how it was presented. I think economists are also people of faith in their own kind of way because they're human beings, and we all are one way or another. But why economists need to interact with Christians who are not economists, and also why Christians who are not economists need to interact with Christians who are economists. And the argument of the lecture was that economics gives you particular tools for describing things as they happen in the world, and particularly ways of thinking in very rigorous ways about correlation, causation, how you try and provide accounts for like why what has happened has happened, and establishing what happened at all in all kinds of ways in the world that economists do. So Sarah Hammersma, who was giving the lecture, was making this plea actually for, like, one of her examples was at some point her pastor had phoned her midweek to ask, can I just run something by you just so I don't get it completely wrong when I'm preaching on Sunday, because I need to talk about something that relates to economics. And I find it really powerful, actually, just as an example of, at one level, you know, humility by a pastor to recognize you don't know everything, and that there are people who have specific knowledge and skills and training in your congregation, so use them well and honor the investment that they've, the investment of their talents. But as well as that, I think that the possibility of that happening between a pastor and a member of a church, it implicitly assumes that there is something like Christian Encyclopedia, which is another way of saying that Christianity is a faith for all of life, and that there is this framework, there's this, it's capacious, and it's bigger than any one of us as individuals or any one of our vocations, and it's big enough to hold together every single member of the church throughout history. We can all lean into it and find that you're never going to kind of fall on the floor because there was nothing to lean on wherever you were. I was wondering how, listening to this lecture last night, if the idea of encyclopedia was quite well known by that name in the Anglo-theological world, would it help us in churches to normalize those kinds of instincts? Say, hey, I'm trained in theology, but I'm not trained in medicine, but I'm going to mention a medical illustration in my sermon. I know there's a doctor, there's a nurse in my congregation, I'll talk to him or talk to her and lean on some of that knowledge. So ways that the body can function together.
Yeah, I think it does presuppose a humility to all the sciences and this kind of the need for dependence. I mean, Bavinck pretty explicitly writes about theology itself as a servant queen, and in that way facilitating the livelihood of the other sciences while still being kind of the premier science itself, which I think we'd all still hold to in this room. But yeah, in that way, this really humility that we need the other sciences for the avenues of study that they pursue, right?
Could you just give us thoughts on two things that are closely related? So talk us through what this means for your work at Cairn University. So you're there, it's a Christian university, and you've got all of these intellectual resources to help you be a theologian in a context like that, where you have all these other Christians teaching different disciplines. But also after that, how is this helpful or useful to Christians at, let's say, secular universities, where you as an individual might have this encyclopedic, or this sense that there's an encyclopedia there that holds everything together in a Christian framework, but you work alongside people who don't think like that at all?
Yeah, that's a great question. I'm probably going to kick the second one to you, James. But the first one, yeah, I think it's been very helpful for me in the classroom. I mean, we don't have an encyclopedia course at Cairn, but essentially, any course that I believe is fitting into one of these fourfold categories that I teach, I'll make sure during syllabus day to kind of introduce the student to the forest again, right? And kind of allow them to see, all right, these are the fourfold categories, but in this course, in Narrative of Redemption, we're really focusing on biblical theology, and therefore the task is going to look like this, compared to an Intro to Christian Theology course, which is much more systematic or dogmatic. And so in that way, I'm trying to, reintroduce the encyclopedia, although I think their eyes do still glaze over whenever I first mention it. It's just, I think it's too long of a word. We need a better word.
Just shorten it to psych.
Psych, that's right, yeah. Yes. That would be kind of almost like psychedelic or something.
I was thinking of a Tom Haverford-style abbreviation. You abbreviate the part nobody expects.
That's right.
Like desserts for desserts and stuff. So let's talk to us about psych.
I think beyond the classroom, it does make me take faculty meetings maybe more serious in that when you're deciding what does and does not belong in the curriculum, how are we labeling courses? You know, this is all important if you're working within, you know, some sort of encyclopedia. If you're not, you know, then it doesn't really matter what you label anything, right? Any course can have its own agenda. And so I think it does give kind of new meaning to the drivel of course descriptions and learning outcomes because it kind of forces you into a larger paradigm.
So one of the questions I have then is, what is lost in the encyclopedia of knowledge if you don't have theological encyclopedia? So if you take Christianity away, what do we lose? So, you know, this takes me right back to the French encyclopedist and their attempt to construe the whole domain of knowledge from a perspective of deism or materialism or something like that. So in terms of the apologetic side, how do you think about Christianity's role in providing the possibility of encyclopedia without some type of like atomistic, mere atomism, something like that?
Yeah, so this is far from hypothetical, right? I mean, like most universities in the Netherlands, at least, just if they have any understanding of encyclopedia, which I kind of think they have because they are one university, theology doesn't play a role. It's not there. And they're all happy, or most are happy that it's not there.
I mean, that was exactly what I was trying to bring up with the Christianity and science reference, this idea that Christianity actually does provide the bedrock for the organism of science. In another place, I think it's in Kenneth and Levin, this essay that Bobbing has in a posthumously published work in 1922, where he argued that, you know, we're not pantheists, and so we don't believe that just one science rules everything. And we're not deists, where we believe that God and the world are so different that theology is not related at all to the different disciplines. But we are Trinitarians. And so because God is a unity in diversity, the university will also have that sort of unity and diversity motif. So he definitely sees that connection between, okay, how you conceive the encyclopedia is very much related to the sort of theology you're presupposing.
Yeah, I think we're going to carry through the neo-Calvinist kind of motifs. I think you end up with some sort of mechanical unity or institutional unity, right, where it's no longer about the knowledge that is actually shaping the individual, coalescing around a particular unity. Rather, it's, okay, well, I belong to this particular institution, and this institution is going to have particular values and mission statements, and therefore, you know, I will always be the alumnus who, you know, goes to the football games, you know, paints my face white, and participates in the knowledge through that, right, through the institution's unity that it provides, rather than the formational aspect of how the unity is being facilitated by the organism of knowledge.
In America.
In America, yes, yes.
So I think a real challenge on the ground is that even if institutions, if universities aren't trying to think in any kind of Christian starting point of encyclopedic knowledge, the elements that they're trying to hold together are the same elements that a Christian worldview tries to hold together, because we live in this finite creation and there are only so many building blocks that we can arrange in a certain number of ways. So we're trying to know the same world in the most immediate sense. And if you're operating within a, let's say, like a Christian encyclopedic framework as an individual in an organization that doesn't do that, you are a particular kind of presence. You might be a minority, but I think in the academy in the West nowadays, even in the secular academy, you have every right to be there and think even just as an individual in those terms. So I think some of the most helpful material on this written recently is by another Edinburgh grad, Simeon Zhu, who wrote this really excellent book on Bavinck's account of theology as a science within the Academy of the Sciences. And most of the book is quite historical in that sense, just, you know, how did this work in Bavinck's context and so on. But the very end of the book is an appeal to Christian theologians in the university world today, where theology is this contested discipline or its place is contested. And what kind of presence does theology enable you to have within that kind of secularized academy? And he makes this very compelling case using Bavinck to say that as a theologian, in the first place, theology has to thrust you into interdisciplinary engagement. you have to take that opportunity and be proactive in that regard, because you have the resources to. And actually, theology, if you're thinking in this kind of encyclopedic sense, again, means that you should want to do that. But beyond that, it also equips you with particular intellectual virtues, which are really like a balance of humility and courage, is how he describes it. And it gives you a very particular kind of presence within even the secular academy. I think that kind of stuff is really well worth reflecting on. And I think there are Christians who have that kind of presence in the secular academy, not just in theology, in lots of different disciplines.
Maybe it identifies how the encyclopedia as an organism is actually a very positive contribution. And when we talk about like theological curriculum or designing courses and programs writ large outside of the encyclopedia, maybe in secular contexts, we're actually living on kind of borrowed capital, right? That knowledge is connected in some way. And this is a Christian concept.
Yeah, I think also part, this is something we've mentioned before on this podcast, but coming back to your question, Corey, about like what do we miss if like theology is not there anymore? Something also Bavinck says in Christianity and Science is that is compartmentalization of the sciences, which is something that's happening across Western academia, right? I mean, there's all kinds of tiny disciplines that just have no idea. Well, they don't have any idea how they connect to the whole of their own discipline, let alone to other disciplines. And that's probably related also to like missing this like vision of unity that encyclopedia gives an interrelatedness. But also the demise of the humanities. That's something Bavinck also almost prophetically writes about in Christianity and Science, that if you ditch theology, then it will be religious studies, but then that will be ditched as well. And then at the end, you will ditch the humanities because there's no ground for such kind of studies. There's only mathematics and physics. There's only like empirical, I think he says it positivist is how he calls it, I think, right? Positivist science is the only thing that's there. And that's also something that's happening, right? I mean, we still have humanities, but it's under a lot of pressure. A lot of people can't really explain why we still do that. And when we think of science, but this is also an English word problem, of course, the Dutch wetenschap has much more the different connotations. It's also something we've evoked before on the podcast. But even in the Dutch language, wetenschap now much more refers to the sciences, the natural sciences, rather than to something like the humanities or other. It's considered less science. And if something like economy, there was also something I think Sarah Hammersma talked about yesterday, that like economy is also moving from being more in the humanities to becoming only a natural sciences. And psychology is the same. It's only based on empirical research. And beyond that, it doesn't want to say anything. Right? So I think these are also directly connected to like losing theology and that unity.
But as Greg was saying, they continue to live on borrowed capital. And as James was saying, they're all still people of faith because they're still made in the image of God. They end up smuggling philosophical, theological even assumptions into their so-called natural disciplines. And they're not even realizing that they're doing that. They're not epistemically self-conscious, that they're always constantly evoking value judgments, philosophical judgments to their work. And so I want to replug, I mean, Chris Watkins' biblical critical theory, and that's why I think his work is so useful and helpful. Is, you know, how do I try to introduce that work in a context where in America people are very suspicious of any talk of critical theory? Well, what I try to say to my students is, well, what's in common between what Watkins is doing and how he's subverting the term critical theory and what critical theorists are doing? Well, critical theory basically says underneath our common debates and conversations are actually particular judgments and biases and dispositions. So in other words, when you have particular laws, you have particular debates that happen throughout history, you look underneath that and what's really behind the debate, what's really behind the law, the conversation, the legislation, is, let's say, racial attitudes and racist judgments. So there's a kind of hermeneutic of suspicion deployed there where you're looking at this piece of legislation and you're saying underneath that are these really quite malevolent attitudes and dispositions that you got to be aware of. And that's really the discipline of critical race theory tries to evoke a lot of that. And what Watkins is doing in a subversion of the term is to say, underneath all of our debates and conversations, all the different sciences are still revelatory pressures, whether it's image of God material, general revelational material, common grace material, suppression of the truth, that's always lurking in the unconscious, so to speak, right? Beneath the discourses of non-believers who try to compartmentalize themselves away from the belief and knowledge of God. And I think that's really potent. And as theologians, you know, to also follow up the insight from Simeon there, we have, I think, a responsibility and an opportunity to show people that in an invitational, non-confrontational way, not in a non-hostile way, show people that, hey, you're actually making these value judgments. Are you aware that you're doing that? You know, Sarah yesterday also spoke in the same way. Are you aware that you're doing that? You're making non-neutral presuppositional judgments that you need to be aware of. And I think the neo-Calvinist tradition is very attuned to that as well.
Yeah, I'm picking up on I think maybe a common thread here of the university context also being formational for the individual. I think this is a kind of a necessary underbelly that comes out of the neo-Calvinist and Christian tradition, that we're not simply training people for economic outcomes. While we hope certainly that they get jobs and find success there, but actually that it's a whole formational process. And the encyclopedia really includes that aspect, that there are certain demands that are placed upon you as a theologian, spiritual demands that you, well, firstly for Bavinck, that you must believe. And then secondly, that you must cultivate this belief. I mean, his demands will go as far as saying you have to have a certain chest capacity so you can speak well in a room that doesn't have microphones. So perhaps not all of them are timely. But it does push on us that education is formational. And I think in our current time, we do see a push against that, and hence the humanities kind of being robbed of their significance.
So we only have a few minutes left. One question that just draws it back to the beginning and is relatively simple, but I think interesting, that's a slight change of subject, is you talked earlier about the fourfold aspect of the discipline of theology or the encyclopedia of theology itself. So maybe is that how Bavinck drew it up? It was a fourfold. I mean, I think we often, if you go to seminary, you get something like a fourfold. And what were the exegetical, practical, how do you think about that? In what ways has that changed? Has it changed much at all in the past century?
Yeah, so the fourfold encyclopedia is practical, systematic, historical, and exegetical. Did I say all four there?
Yeah.
Yeah. The one that seems to shift the most is systematic, is sometimes called dogmatic, and there's kind of this going toing and froing between the two. And that's really because of really the science of systematic theology itself maybe is a bit confused at times in terms of how we talk about it as theologians or how lay people talk about it, where systematic theology presupposes that you're working out of the wholeness of the Christian tradition, and dogmatics presupposes that you're working out of a particular tradition. Not that you can't aspire to Reformed Catholic ends within dogmatics, mm-hmm. But they're really slightly different enterprises in that way. And so, maybe you could contrast Barth and Bavinck here, right? Bavinck perceives himself to be doing specifically Reformed confessional dogmatics, whereas Barth, even though he calls it dogmatics, the adjective there is really striving to do something maybe more holistic.
I think it's also connected to the Lotzai method, right? So dogmatics is really the idea that you can only do dogmatics per Lotzai. So say, okay, we're not going to talk about soteriology. We're not going to talk about creation ecclesiology. And I think it also wants to stay away from systems, like making it all too ready and created as a whole, right? So in back in Utrecht, they changed, it was Kampen back then, from dogmatique to systematische theologie, so systematic theology. I think that happened maybe 30 years ago. I often think now, I will be teaching systematic theology soon. I often think, well, I think I actually prefer the dogmatique rather than the systematic theology. Also in terms of how it sounds outside. If I say to people I teach systematic theology, it looks like, systematic. It just doesn't sound so good. It sounds maybe too, I don't know, what's a good word? As if you want to achieve or put a system upon something. Not that dogmatique is so, doesn't sound so great. I mean, it sounds like rigid. So maybe we need another term yet, but yeah.
It's possible. I think when students sit in my office and they look up at my beautiful Edinburgh diploma, they often read it as systemic. theology instead of systematic, which would have its own problems.
So I think dogmatic theology is also, or systematic theology in the pure sense is descriptive, and then dogmatics is actually normative in the deepest sense, the things that must be believed as well. And there's a difference between the two. Greg, it's been great to have you on the podcast at long last. For listeners who want to follow your work, what are you working on? What's coming out next? And where can people follow you?
Yeah, so Cam and I most recently finished up a translation on J.H. Bavinck's Jesus as Caretaker of Souls. So we're looking to land that with a publisher. And I think it's a profitable work, looking at how Jesus really looked after his disciples and what we might learn from his way of discipling. In terms of finding me, I mean, I'm on Twitter. Often when I mention Twitter in class, my students give me weird looks now because I think it's no longer vogue at all. But I am on there, G_Parker_Jr. And then you can always find me on the Karen website. It's been a pleasure. Thank you so much for having me on. I am disappointed that we didn't get to talk about Dune at all. Perhaps we'll have to return to talk about that.
Great. Thanks so much, Greg. It's been a pleasure. Great. This has been a live discussion with the Grayson Common team and our guest, Dr. Greg Parker of Karen University. Thank you very much for listening to this new season of Grayson Common. If you don't subscribe, please do click subscribe on whatever podcast provider you use. All the links to books mentioned will be in the show notes. And we would also like to acknowledge grant from the Abraham Kuyper Leadership Fund, which has enabled us to be together to record live here in Grand Rapids. Once again, this is Grace in Common.